about charging toward Carrot. As they approached, he sensed the Imperial reinforcements in the hall outside, scrambling to restore power to the sealed door so they could join the fray. Knowing he was running out of time, Nostoral switched tactics again. He thrust out with a powerful force wave, sweeping them both off their feet. But before he could finish off his prone opponents, Carrot unleashed a blast of cackling dark side energy in his direction. Nostoral leapt clear, the deadly blue lightning scorching the floor where he had been standing an instant before. He threw his lightsaber in Carrot's direction, sending it end over end on a direct line with his target. The Faline parried the attack with her own blade, though she was forced to retreat a step to absorb the impact. Nostoral was already in motion, charging past her apprentices before they could scramble to their feet. His lightsaber flew back into his outstretched palm as he fell on Carrot. He had trained her in Nemon, the sixth and most balanced form of lightsaber combat. Malgus might have taught her other styles, but faced with Nostoral's furious assault, she instinctively fell back into the one she had learned before all others. Nemon lent itself well to the Jedi ways, eschewing naked aggression for balance and economy of movement that relied on focus and precision. As a Sith Lord who drew her strength from channeling the raw emotional fury of the dark side, the style compromised Carrot's abilities. The effect was minimal, but it was more than enough for Nostoral to exploit. He used a quick shove with the Force to send her off balance, and brought his lightsaber in high to strike at her shoulder. When she raised her own blade to block the blow, he dropped low and took her feet out from under her with a sweep of his leg. Carrot toppled over, but the Jedi was forced to turn his back on her to engage the female Sith as she leapt to Carrot's aid. They exchanged a quick series of blows, plenty of time for Carrot to regain her feet. Instead of attempting to finish Nostoral off by attacking from his flank, however, she retreated from the melee, putting the preservation of her own life above the opportunity to finish off her opponent. The male apprentice joined in a second later, and Nostoral switched to the defensive Sarisu form. He could sense fatigue seeping into his muscles. The toll of the battle was wearing him down, fractionally slowing his blade and leaving him more vulnerable to the force attacks of his enemies. An instant later, the door whooshed open, and a dozen Imperial guards spilled into the room. Carrot held up a hand to indicate they should hold their fire.
"The outcome is inevitable," Carrot called out to him as he fought off the twin attacks of her apprentices. "I sense your exhaustion. Throw down your weapon, and I will let you beg for mercy."
Nostoral hadn't expected to win the battle. From the moment he decided to board the Ascendant Sphere, he'd known defeating Carrot was a near impossibility. But he wasn't about to surrender and grovel at her feet, if for no other reason than that if he did, she would be suspicious, and his true plan would never work.
"I didn't come here seeking victory."
Carrot's head tilted to the side as she searched for the meaning behind his words. Failing to grasp it, she turned to the soldiers arrayed just inside the door.
"I want him alive," she told the captain.
Nostoral used the last of his dwindling strength to call on the Force for a final desperate leap that sent him hurtling over the apprentices' heads toward his former Padawan. The attack was doomed to failure. There were a dozen ways Carrot could have avoided or repelled the attack, but she didn't even have to react, as the soldiers opened fire with a dozen blasters, all set to stun. The bolts knocked the Jedi from the air and sent him slamming hard to the ground. His lightsaber fell from his paralyzed fingers, the blade extinguished as the hilt clattered to the floor. As he lay there face down, struggling to cling to consciousness, Carrot strode over and picked up his lightsaber, tucking it into her belt like a hunter claiming a trophy from a prized kill. She rolled him over onto his back with her boot, then crouched down to peer into his masked face.
"You know you couldn't win this battle, so why did you really come here?"
Nostoral had no intention of answering her question, but even if he had, his voice would have been drowned out by the sounds of an alarm ringing through the ship. Carrot snapped her head in the direction of the guard captain, who was listening intently to a message coming over the receiver in his ear.
"Reva Station is under attack," he blurted out. "A Republic fleet has been detected in the sector. ETA, 16 minutes.
Activate our shields,
Carrot answered, concerned but not panicked.
Recall all crew to their posts. We leave dock in 12 minutes. Anyone not on board will be left behind and face a full court-martial.
As the captain relayed her commands to the person on the other end of the transmission, Carrot turned back to look down at Nosterol.
Was this your plan? Sacrifice yourself so the Republic could catch us in port and unprepared? Or is there more to your scheme?
Nosterol stayed silent, the edges of his vision growing dim as the blackness closed in, the blaring alarms growing fainter and more distant. Just before he finally lost consciousness, he heard Carrot say,
"This is another battle you cannot win. The Imperial interrogators will make you tell me everything."
Reaver Station was in chaos. The alarms echoing through the station were quickly matched by alarms from every ship docked in the hangars as the central tower spread word of the Republic fleet closing in. Men and women sprinted back to their vessels, scrambling to get to their battle stations before the enemy arrived. Theron didn't know how long it would take for his ruse to be discovered, but he knew he had to act fast. He ran from the guard post, joining the stampede of soldiers bearing down on the hangar where the Ascendant Spear was docked. As he burst into the bay, he was swept up in the crowd and carried toward the ramps. The guards keeping the crew from boarding the ship were gone, either recalled onto the spear or overwhelmed by the sudden crush of people scrambling to get to their posts. Theron continued to let the crowd carry him along, heading up the ramp and into the vessel. Once aboard, the crowd thinned quickly as people broke off in different directions, heading to their assigned stations. Theron did his best to look like he knew where he was going, though in truth, he had no idea. He'd only had time to plan out how he'd get himself on the ship. Now that he was aboard, he needed to figure out something new, and it was hard to concentrate due to the incessant clang of the spear's warning klaxon. It wasn't unheard of for new crew members to get lost when first assigned to a ship as large as the Ascendant Spear, and there were diagrams of the ship's basic layout posted at several places along the bulkheads. He stopped to check one, quickly memorizing the layout before choosing his destination. He needed somewhere with access to the ship's main systems, so he could slice in and plant the virus, but it had to be isolated enough for him to work in private. His eyes fell on the engine room near the rear of the ship, separated from the rest of the vessel by a heavily shielded bulkhead to guard against explosions and radioactive discharges. It was accessible only through a single maintenance hatch. Moving with a new sense of purpose, he worked his way through the ship toward the turbo lift leading down to the vessel's lowest level. He encountered fewer and fewer people as he went, and by the time he reached the lift, he was alone. Before he could press the button to call it, the doors slid open to reveal a short, heavyset woman in a major's uniform.
"Corporal,"
she snapped on seeing Theron waiting for the elevator.
"Where do you think you're going?"
"Sorry, sir,"
Theron said, slurring his words and snapping off a sloppy salute. He squinted, one eye closed, as he swayed unsteadily on his feet.
"Gotta get to my post."
"This lift is reserved,"
she barked, her voice even louder than the incessant alarms.
"Authorized personnel only."
"Alarms woke me up,"
Theron mumbled.
"Gotta get to engineering.
"You're drunk,"
she spat, her voice filled with disgust.
"Are you scheduled for duty?"
0900,
he replied.
"That's not for another 6 hours,"
she said with an exasperated shake of her head.
"Go back and sleep it off in your bunk."
"Sure thing, sir,"
Theron said, fumbling out another clumsy salute. He turned and staggered off in the opposite direction, down the corridor and around the corner. Once he was out of sight, he dropped the act and moved quickly down the passage, taking a series of twists and turns that eventually doubled him back to the turbolift. Peering around the corner, he made sure the major was gone before making a dash for the lift. He waited impatiently for the doors to open, then slipped inside and punched the button for G-Deck, hoping he wouldn't run into anyone else. Luck was with him. He didn't see anybody as he made his way from the elevator to the engine room's access hatch. Unlike the automated doors controlled by access panels, this was an old Durasteel hinge model, opened by turning a heavy wheel in the center of the hatch. The wheel was stiff from lack of use, and despite his best efforts, Theron couldn't budge it. He realized the maintenance crew probably used a wrench to gain the necessary leverage, but all he had was his pistol. He looked around the empty corridor, trying to find something else he could use. Seeing nothing, he shrugged and pulled the blaster from the holster on his hip, jamming it into the spokes of the door's wheel. Grabbing the pistol's grip with one hand and the barrel with the other, he pulled for all he was worth. The veins on his neck bulged as his muscles strained. Just as he thought he was about to pass out from the effort, the wheel let loose with a groan and moved a quarter turn. Theron adjusted his grip on the pistol and pulled again. The wheel moved more easily this time, another quarter turn. He re-gripped for a third time and pulled. The wheel completed its revolution, and the door popped open with a loud clang. Standing motionless, he waited to see if anyone would respond to the noise, but all he heard was the clanging alarm. When he removed the pistol from the spokes of the wheel, he noticed that the barrel had been bent. The weapon was useless. Out of habit, he slapped it into his leg holster, then stepped in through the hatch, pulling the heavy Durasteel door closed behind him. He turned the wheel on the inside a quarter turn, enough to keep the hatch from popping open, but not so far he'd have to struggle to open it when he was ready to get out. He was standing on a narrow metal walkway that ran the full 40-meter length of the engine room. To his left was a reinforced bulkhead. To his right, the Spear's massive hyperdrive and the enormous ion engines that propelled the ship when it moved at sublight speeds. The walls and ceiling were covered with a maze of pipes, tubes, cords, and wires running among hundreds of seemingly random placed electrical boxes, fuse panels, and computer chip relays. In addition to the alarms he could still hear and feel through the vibrations in the walkway, there was a steady, low-pitched hum coming from the ion engines. The air in the engine room was 20 degrees warmer than the corridor he had just come in from, and it smelled of ozone and burning plastic.
"If the heat doesn't make me pass out, the fumes just might," Theron thought.
There were no control panels down here in the bowels of the ship, but Theron knew he could slice the Spear by tapping directly into the main system. All he had to do was figure out which of the hundreds of wires and relays connected the engine room to the primary command console on the bridge.
"Shouldn't take more than a few hours, right?"
To his relief, the clanging alarms finally stopped. The blessed silence was broken by two long blasts from a distant horn, and the ground shifted under his feet as the Ascendant Spear disengaged from Reaver Station.
"Guess you're not leaving anytime soon," he thought. "Might as well get to work."
Chapter 25. The Imperial Shuttle's 10-hour journey from Reaver Station back to Jagani Port gave Tefith plenty of time to think about her deal with Theron. She wasn't entirely sure what had happened, but the basic details were clear. Theron and the weird-looking Jedi were trying something crazy and foolish, and if she didn't deliver her message to Grandmaster Satil Shan, a lot of people were going to die. She tried to tell herself she didn't really care what happened to a bunch of people she'd never met. But during the long flight, her mind kept conjuring up images of orbital cities and ruins. The bodies of men, women, and children scattered among the wreckage. She'd seen plenty of pictures of death and destruction on the holovids and never given them a second thought. But this was different. Those people were already dead. There was no point worrying about them. The ones on Duro were still alive.
"No profit for us in letting them die," she thought,
reminding herself why she was really doing this. Theron had promised her a big, fat payday when this was all over, It wasn't like she was taking any real risk. Agreeing to the job had actually gotten her off Reaver Station before the Jedi and Theron pulled off whatever crazy stunt they were planning.
Only risk is if Theron doesn't make it, she thought.
She realized the thought of him dying on Reaver Station actually bothered her more than thinking of all the nameless victims on Duro. Try as she might, she couldn't convince herself it was entirely because he wouldn't be able to pay her. She slept for a few hours, letting the shuttle's autopilot navigate through hyperspace. She dreamed of Nagani Jo, the crazy old Jedi who'd thrown himself in front of a blaster bolt meant for her, sacrificing his life for her own. But she didn't dream of their time together or his death. In her dreams, it was like the old man had never left. Tepeth was on the Imperial shuttle, heading back to Jagani. Nagani Jo was sitting in the seat beside her. His scraggly gray hair and bushy eyebrows were wild and disheveled. Looking at him, it wouldn't be hard to imagine he had never owned a comb in his life. He wore an old Jedi robe, wrinkled and stained, with the hood thrown back. There were several charred holes in his chest where the blasters had ripped through him, but his blue eyes were sharp and bright.
I expected better from you, Tepeth, he said. You think I gave up my life just so you could keep on working for the Black Sun?
Work for old Teon Brotherhood now.
That's not the point.
Big things ahead for us.
At least we agree on that.
Why did you save us?
A beep from the autopilot alerting her that they were preparing to drop out of hyperspace startled her awake before the man in her dream could give her an answer.
Stupid Jedi,
Tepeth muttered as she switched the shuttle over to manual control. She dropped from hyperspace in the Deceiver system, charted a course for the shuttle to bring her into Jagani port, then opened a holochannel.
Welcome back, sunshine,
Gorbich said once the holo was connected.
Quick turnaround. I guess everything must have gone real smooth.
Not smooth. Left Jedi and Theron at Reaver Station.
Gorbich chuckled.
Sounds like a good story. Lay it on me.
Not overcome, Channels. Meet us at Jedi's fancy shuttle. You move it?
Nah, it's still in the hangar at Jagani Port. How long till you get there?
30 minutes,
she said, flicking off the holo so she wouldn't have to deal with Gorbich for 1 second longer than absolutely necessary. By the time she arrived at the hangar where the Prosperity was parked, Gorbich was already waiting for her.
Okay, sunshine, we're here. So what's the deal? Why'd you ditch the others?
She hesitated, choosing her words carefully. She wanted to tell Gorbich as little about what had happened as possible. If he knew Theron had offered her 10,000 credits... he'd want a cut.
Didn't teach them. Told us to go. Need us to deliver a message.
I don't follow,
Gorbich said, scratching his head.
You going back to pick them up later?
Not part of the plan.
So how are they going to get off Reaver Station?
Tepeth shrugged.
Never told us. Just said take shuttle, go deliver message.
Gorbich shook his head.
I knew they were up to something funny. This won't come back later and bite me when I'm not looking, will it?
You'll be fine,
the Twi'lek assured him. Gorbich crossed his arms and stared at Tepeth, his eyes staying above the neck for a change.
I know you're keeping something from me, sunshine, but I'll let it slide since you set this whole deal up.
Still owe us our cuts,
she reminded him.
Don't worry, I got the credits stashed away somewhere safe.
Gorbich laughed, a mean, spiteful sound.
Guess we aren't gonna get those bonus credits your friend promised, though.
Might still make it off Reaver Station,
Tepeth said, a little more defensively than she intended.
I'm just gonna assume he's not coming back,
Gorbich said.
Good thing we took this shuttle for collateral. Already got a couple of buyers lined up.
Seeing Tepeth scowl, he added,
Hey, I didn't think any of you was going to make it back.
Why, you sent us with them? Want to keep all the credits for yourself?
Water under the bridge, sunshine,
he said with an indifferent shrug.
Now that you're back, I'm happy to share.
Cancel shuttle,
she told him, already tiring of the conversation.
Needed to deliver a message.
Whoa, hold on a second. What are you talking about? You think I'm just gonna let you take off in my collateral?
Gorbachev's eyes narrowed.
How do I know you and your friends aren't trying to pull a fast one? You say they're still on Riva Station, but for all I know, you dropped them off at some luxury resort. Then they send you back here to get the Prosperity so you can all meet up later and get out of paying me the rest of the credits I was promised.
Idiot,
Tifa said with a shake of her head, turning away from him and heading toward the shuttle.
One more step and I ventilate your pretty little skull, sunshine.
She turned around slowly to see Gorbachev had drawn his blaster and was pointing it right at her.
Saved your life on Nash Hadar,
she hissed.
That's why I didn't shoot you in the back,
he admitted.
But I don't like being played, so stop holding out and tell me what's really going on.
Tefet bit her lip, trying to find a way to talk herself out of this without having to cut Gorbachev in on her side deal. In the end, she couldn't do it.
Theron offered 10,000 credits to deliver a message to Coruscant. Got to take fancy shuttle to get there in time.
10,000 credits, huh?
Gorbachev lowered his blaster, though he didn't put it away.
Cut you in for 3,
Tefet said.
Hold on a second, sunshine,
he said, holding up his free hand.
You really believe you're gonna get 10,000 credits just to deliver a message to Coruscant? You're dreaming.
Deal's good,
she insisted, not wanting to get into the details.
You don't think Coruscant Customs has access to the Prosperity's records? They'll toss you in jail for theft the second you touch down.
Tefet hadn't considered that. Hopefully she'd be able to convince the authorities that she really did have an urgent message for Grandmaster Satil Shan.
Ha! Didn't think of that, did you?
Gorbachev gloated, recognizing the reason for her silence.
See, that's why you need me around, watching out for you.
Worth the risk,
Tefet argued.
10,000 credits, too good to pass up.
If he pays you. He already owes us another 20 on credit. Remember how he renegotiated the original deal? He says 10 now, but when it comes time to pay, who knows how much he'll actually be willing to fork over? Maybe 0.
Won't be 0,
Tefet grumbled.
Even if he comes through with the 10 he promised and the 20 he already owes us, I got a better deal for you,
Gorbachev said.
Forget about the message. We sell the Prosperity and split the profit. We both come out way ahead in that game.
Tefet wasn't surprised by Gorbachev's plan. He was a despicable man with no honor. But he knew how to turn a profit. And everything he'd said about Theron was true. Theron had reneged on the original deal. And even if she delivered the message and he didn't double-cross her, there was a good chance whatever crazy plan he was trying to pull off wouldn't work. If he was killed or captured by the Sith, she could kiss her credits goodbye.
Well, sunshine, what's it gonna be?
How much we get for the shuttle?
50,000, easy. Plus I still got your cut of the 30 I stashed away.
If she tried to help Theron, Gorbachev might just shoot her where she stood. Even if she tricked or overpowered him, her days with the old Tian Brotherhood would be over. And there was a good chance she might not get paid anyway. Or she could abandon Theron, keep working with Gorbachev, and continue climbing the ranks of the Brotherhood while making an easy 40,000 credits.
Good money, sunshine,
Gorbachev prodded.
Enough to ease any guilt about betraying a friend.
And how long do you betray us?
Tefet thought. Tefet sprang into action, hoping to catch Gorbachev off guard as he waited for her answer. He was standing 3 steps away from her, his gun still pointed casually at the ground. Her first step was free. On her second, his eyes went wide with the realization of what was happening. On the third, he was bringing the gun up. But he only got it halfway before she knocked it out of his hand with a spinning back kick. She followed it up with a jumping front kick, swinging her foot as hard as she could and catching him right between the legs. Gorbachev collapsed on the ground, curled up in the fetal position, groaning softly. Tefet scooped up his fallen pistol, pointed it at him, then decided not to pull the trigger. Instead, she tucked it into her belt and raced over to the shuttle. She punched in the access code, and the Prosperity's boarding ramp descended with a soft hiss from the pressurized cabin. She ran up it, turning to glance back at Gorbachev. He was still on the floor, but he was crawling toward the ship. He met her eye with a hate-filled gaze. Something in that look made Tefeth realize he wasn't done yet. Reacting on pure instinct, she threw herself back and to the side, grabbing one of the boarding ram struts to keep from falling off. At the same time, Gorbachev's hand flickered, dropping to the sharpened blade he kept strapped to his thigh, and hurling it in her direction with a single well-practiced motion, almost too quick for the eye to follow. The blade buried itself deep in Tefeth's shoulder, almost knocking her off the boarding ramp. Using the strut for leverage, she hauled herself into the ship and hit the button to close the boarding ramp behind her, acutely aware that if she hadn't tried to get out of the way, the blade now protruding from her shoulder would have buried itself deep in her back. Ignoring her injury, she rushed to the cockpit, fired up the engine, sent the signal to open the hangar doors, and took to the air. Back on the ground, Gorbachev crawled over to the control panel and hauled himself up, slamming the button to close the hangar doors with his fist. Tefeth saw the hangar doors stop at halfway open, then slowly start to close again. She gritted her teeth, yanked back hard on the control stick to send the ship hurtling forward, and braced for impact. The Prosperity's hull, like everything else about the vessel, was top of the line. The multiple layers of durasteel plating and the reinforced frame struck the hangar's doors and wrenched them off their hinges, sending them flying as the thrusters powered the ship on through and up into the sky. Climbing toward the upper atmosphere, Tefeth felt a subtle shimmy in the shuttle's formerly velvet-smooth ride, but checking the ship's instrument panel showed no significant damage. A few minutes later, she was far enough away from the planet's gravitational field to engage the hyperspace drive and activate the advanced autopilot to take her to Coruscant. Only then did she tend to her wounded shoulder, digging out the med kit from beneath the pilot seat. She inspected the blade, making sure she wouldn't bleed out if she pulled it free. Fortunately, it had struck muscle and bone rather than a major artery, and she was able to remove it without any real difficulty, though doing so made her tilt her head back and scream. Blocking out the pain, she treated and dressed the wound with the efficiency of one all too familiar with administering back-alley medicine. She inspected her work one final time before finally taking a pair of colto-filled hypodermics and jabbing them into her thigh. The pain disappeared almost instantly, and she felt a pleasant warmth spreading through her. She shifted in her seat, and the chair responded by automatically adjusting itself to her new position, enveloping her in luxurious comfort. She turned her head to the side and saw Nagani Zhou once again sitting in the seat beside her.
"I'm proud of you, my girl, for sparing Gorbachev and for making the right choice."
"No. Maybe stupid Jedi leave us alone,"
she murmured, her words tailing off into a soft snore.
"I have the latest casualty estimates for tomorrow's attack on Duro," the director said.
"Do you really think I want to see them?"
Jace asked. The Supreme Commander was slumped in the chair behind his desk, his hand clutching an empty glass. He leaned forward and grabbed the long neck of the half-full bottle in front of him and refilled his drink for what Marcus guessed wasn't the first time this evening.
"The extra patrols you're sending help. Not much, but a little."
"We save a few hundred," Jace grunted bitterly. "But we still sacrifice thousands."
"We could try to come up with an excuse to have an actual fleet orbiting the planet," the director suggested. "Make up some honor to give one of Duro's citizens. Have the ships there as part of the celebration."
"Imagine you're the Imperial Minister of Logistics," Jace said, his words clear despite the alcohol he'd consumed. "What would you think if you found a ceremonial fleet stationed at Duro when you launched your surprise attack? Would you believe it was just coincidence?"
The director sighed.
"No. I think the cipher codes had been compromised."
Jace raised his drink in a silent toast to his honesty, then downed it in a single gulp.
"Grab yourself a glass," he said, nodding over to the bar in the corner as he refilled his own.
The director did just that before sitting in one of the chairs on the opposite side of the Supreme Commander's desk. Jace held the bottle up, and Marcus extended his glass.
"You think Theron's going to follow through on the mission?"
Jace asked as he poured. Marcus drained half his drink before answering.
He's my best agent.
You used to say he was one of the best, Jace noted.
I upgraded him after he brought back the Black Cipher.
What about Nosterol? He's a Jedi.
Jace emptied his glass again.
They're not always great at following orders that don't fit their understanding of the universe.
I think he's smart enough to understand why we had to do this. And aborting the mission doesn't help Duro.
So you think they'll go forward?
I think so. They both care too much about the Republic to let this go off the rails.
And after this is over, after we bring down the Spear and finally put an end to this blasted war, you think Theron will ever forgive me?
The director didn't answer. Instead, he just drained what was left of his drink.
Do you support my decision?
Jace wanted to know.
I do, Marcus said. It's the right call. Don't know if I could have made it, though. And I don't know how either of us is supposed to live with it.
Jace grabbed the bottle and refilled their glasses.
Making a decision like this is brutal,
the Supreme Commander agreed.
But living with it is worse.
Chapter 26. Hunched over one of the many computer relay panels in the Ascendant Spear's engine room, Theron wiped the sweat away from his brow before it ran down and stung his eyes. With the help of his slicer spike, he tapped into the panel and ran a diagnostic search to map out the various systems it was connected to. Theron had been hiding in the engine room ever since the Spear left Reaver Station. He had no way to get off the vessel until it docked again, short of stealing an escape pod, which would trigger an emergency alarm and get him blasted out of existence. Fortunately, the hours he'd been stuck on the narrow walkway in the sweltering, reeking engine room had actually proved beneficial. Realizing he wasn't going anywhere soon, Theron had spent his time trying to get a better understanding of the vessel's inner workings. Mapping each relay individually was a simple but time-consuming process, one he'd already repeated over a dozen times. But the grueling work was the key to piecing together a complete picture of the Spear's control systems. There was no single central network connecting everything. Each system was controlled independently, linked to several different relays that could allow functionality to be rerouted through multiple pathways if something went wrong. His exploration of the engine room was proving to be simultaneously exhausting, fascinating, and disheartening. The complexity of the ship was mind-boggling. It was the crowning achievement of Darth Mekkis's experimental weapons program. SIS had long suspected that there was some kind of link between the vessel itself and whoever was in command. Mekkis had specialized in combining biology and cybernetics. But the full scope of the symbiotic relationship went far beyond anything that they had theorized. Whenever Theron sliced into a computer terminal, his cybernetic implants allowed him to interface directly with the network. But there was still a wall of separation, a clear distinction between user and device. Mekkis had found a way to tear down that wall. When Carid was in command of the Spear, the ship became part of her. Or maybe she became part of the ship. They were inseparable. The connection gave her the ability to read and react almost instantly during a battle. The Spear's sensors relaying information directly into her awareness, then responding immediately to her commands. It also gave her a heightened awareness of everything that was happening with the vessel's systems while she was linked to the ship. Theron would have to be extremely cautious with anything he did, taking extra care to use a light touch so Carid wouldn't sense his presence. And he realized the original plan of planting a dormant virus probably wouldn't work. Even if Carid didn't notice the intrusion, the Spear had multiple layers of safeguards and redundancies that would quickly isolate and disable the virus. The relays cutting off the malware as they rerouted the damaged functions through a new path. The only hope of effectively sabotaging the vessel was for Theron to be actively slicing the system while the Spear was in battle, shifting and switching his electronic attacks to stay a step ahead of the vessel's security protocols. The dilemma of how he was supposed to actually get off the ship if he was actively sabotaging it in the middle of a battle was something he tried not to worry about for the moment. On the plus side, the Spear's unique design allowed Theron's own cybernetic implants to operate at peak efficiency while he was plugged into the ship, giving him a level of access unlike anything he'd experienced before. He'd already managed to patch into the ship's internal communications, allowing the implant in his ear to receive all their transmissions.
Red Patrol checking in. E-deck is clear. Proceeding to F-deck.
They're inside, and disconnected his slicer spike from the panel. He stood up straight, stretching to ease a crick in his back. Tapping into the comm systems had allowed him to follow the progress of the security patrols Carrot had dispatched once she realized the Republic fleet hadn't really existed. Theron had been tracking them closely as they systematically worked their way through each level of the vessel, wing by wing. He hated to interrupt his work, but it was time to move if he didn't want to be discovered. He went to the Durasteel maintenance hatch and slowly turned the wheel to open it. There was a sharp clink as the hatch popped free, and a soft squeak from the hinges as it swung open. Theron poked his head out into the corridor, not expecting to see anyone, but also not willing to take any chances. His only weapon was the blaster he had tucked in the holster of his uniform, but he had no intention of firing it after bending the barrel prying open the engine room security hatch. Fortunately, the hall was deserted, so he climbed out and closed the hatch behind him, trying not to make any noise. He worked his way down the hall, listening intently for the footsteps of anyone approaching. It wasn't likely he would run into anybody. G-Deck consisted primarily of the engine room, and, way on the opposite end, the Spear's private command chamber. Apart from the security sweep, nobody had any reason to be on the level. Even Carrot wouldn't venture down unless the Spear was about to go into battle. Two turbo lifts, one near the engine room at the stern, the other near the command chamber at the bow, were the only ways to access the lowest level of the ship. Theron knew the security patrols worked from stern to bow, so he carefully made his way toward the stern, away from the lift he had taken when he first boarded the vessel. Because of the size and irregular shape of the ion and hypermatter drives, the two sides of G-Deck weren't connected by a single straight corridor. The hull twisted and turned. At each bend, Theron paused and peeked around the corner. Knowing if he was discovered, he would have a hard time explaining his presence. After several minutes of careful skulking, he finally reached the turbo lift near the front of the vessel. The hull continued another 30 meters before finally terminating in a large sealed door. Theron knew the Spear's command chamber lay beyond, but he resisted the urge to go investigate. The engine room was where he could do the most damage. No point in risking exposure by snooping around just to satisfy his curiosity. He hit the panel on the turbo lift, contemplating his next move as he waited for it to arrive. In his ear, he could hear the progress of the security team as they reported back each time they cleared another section of the deck above him. Theron considered heading up to the crew quarters on C-deck. He could look for an untended cabin where he could switch his grubby uniform for fresh clothes, leaving him less likely to draw attention if he needed to move around the ship. He might even get a chance to swap his blaster for one that worked. But whoever's uniform and weapon he borrowed was likely to notice if one or the other was missing, and that could reinforce suspicions about a stowaway on board. The last thing he needed to worry about was another round of security sweeps. When the turbolift arrived, he realized he'd have more luck going to the laundry on E-deck. He could also try to sneak something to eat from the nearby food prep areas in the galley kitchens, and his sweaty, shoddy appearance was less likely to draw attention among crew who spent their days working around steam-belching laundry machines, smoking ovens, and splattering pots and cauldrons. Hitting the button, he took several deep breaths to get into character, mentally throwing together a number of potential excuses and explanations in case anyone caught him helping himself to a uniform or stealing some extra food. Stepping off the lift, he saw he didn't have to worry. E-deck was a hub of frenetic activity. The men and women assigned to the military's essential but often forgotten service roles, rushing back and forth with the energy and focus of a highly trained special ops team. Too absorbed in their own tasks to worry about a junior officer wandering through, none of them paid Theron any attention. In his earpiece, he heard another update from the security team. By Theron's estimate, they were halfway done with their sweep through F-deck. Making his way into the laundry, Theron snagged a pair of pants and a top that looked as if they would fit and tucked them under his arm. Careful not to act suspicious, he made his way over to a hidden corner by one of the washing machines. ducked behind it, and stripped off his grimy clothes. Once he had the new uniform on, he was pleasantly surprised to see he had been promoted to captain. Given the harsh penalties for insubordination in the Empire, it was unlikely anyone below his rank would want to draw attention to themselves by confronting him.
If I could find a Grand Moff's outfit, I might just be able to walk into the bridge and take command, Theron thought.
Though it was only a joke, the thought gave Theron pause. If he could somehow get his hands on some explosives, say from the armory, he could plant them in the engine room and wreak significant damage. As quickly as the idea came to mind, however, he dismissed it. Security around the armory would be much tighter than what he faced here, and even an officer requisitioning several kilograms of explosives was bound to raise questions he couldn't answer. Sticking with his original plan, he made his way into the kitchens, dumping his soiled uniform into a hamper half full of dirty laundry. As he'd hoped, the enlisted men and women did their best to avoid making eye contact with him as he marched past. His chest puffed out with what he hoped was the appropriate level of imperial arrogance and privilege. In the kitchen, he resisted the urge to go after the hot food being prepared for the crew's next meal, despite his grumbling stomach. Instead, he made his way into the storage lockers in the back and grabbed a pair of ration packs. A young man in cook's garb gave him a curious look, but when Theron narrowed his eyes at the soldier, his gaze snapped down to the floor. Without saying anything, Theron marched out with his prize and back into the hall. Another update in his ear informed him the security team had completed the sweep of F-Deck and was moving on. Theron made his way back out into the hall and headed down the length of the ship toward the turbolift at the stern. As he reached it, he heard another update from the security team.
Engine room is clear. Moving on.
He called the turbolift, stepped inside, and thumbed the button for G-Deck to complete his circuitous route and return him to where he started. The corridor was empty as he stepped off the lift. The security patrol had already moved on to the other side of the ship. The wheel on the access hatch turned easier this time, loosened up by its recent use. Back inside the engine room, he stripped off the captain's uniform, carefully folding it and setting it in the metal walkway just inside the hatch, along with his bent pistol, his slicer spike, and one of the ration packs he'd stolen. He took a few minutes to consume the contents of the second ration pack. By the time he was done eating, he was already covered in sweat. He'd hoped the heat would be more bearable wearing only his underwear and boots. It wasn't, but at least his new uniform wouldn't end up covered in dirt and sweat stains. Retrieving his slicer spike, he returned to the arduous task of learning everything he possibly could about the Ascendant Spear. A jolt of excruciating pain jarred Nostoral back to consciousness. It felt as if he were being cooked alive from the inside. His eyes popped open wide, adding to his suffering. Someone had removed his protective goggles, and the oxygen-rich atmosphere of the ship felt like acid on his pupils. Squeezing his tortured eyes shut, he let loose a scream, the sound muffled by his breathing mask.
"He's awake,"
he heard Darth Kerrid say, and the burning agony suddenly stopped. Though still unable to open his eyes, the Keldor was able to take stock of his surroundings. He was lying on a hard platform or table set at a 45-degree angle, his wrists and ankles tightly shackled so that he was spread-eagled against the surface. His robe and most of his clothes had been stripped away, leaving him almost naked. In addition to Kerrid, there were others in the room with him. He recognized the presence of the female Sith apprentice, though he couldn't sense Kerrid's male follower anywhere close by. And there were two others. He couldn't feel the dark side emanating from them, so he assumed they were not Sith, but rather Imperial soldiers, guards, or specially trained interrogators. He heard footsteps approaching, then the sound of Darth Kerrid's voice much closer than before.
"We know the attack on Reaver Station was staged," she said, her voice filled with an icy calm. "But I don't understand why. What was the purpose of setting off a false alarm?"
The Jedi didn't know what she was talking about, but he suspected Theron had something to do with it. Whatever his partner had been up to, he hoped it had worked. If Theron hadn't successfully planted the virus in the Spear's systems, Nostoral's plan was doomed to fail.
"Hit him again," Darth Kerrid said.
tired of waiting for him to answer her question. This time, his body felt not heat, but a strange kind of internalized pressure. His lungs and stomach expanded, as if rapidly filling up with air. His arteries and veins engorged with blood. His arms and legs swelled with fluid. The restraints on his wrists and ankles biting hard into his swelling flesh. His eyes bulged against his lids, and every organ in his body felt stretched and distended, ready to burst or tear apart. Nostoral screamed again through his mask. The pain was unlike anything he had ever felt before. The experience uniquely horrifying. And then, suddenly it was gone. Nostoral's body went limp, like a partially deflated balloon. A second later, he began to tremble, every muscle quivering involuntarily. The spasm lasted for several seconds before he was finally able to calm his mind and regain control of his physical body.
"Darth Mekkis was a true genius," Carrot said with obvious admiration. "She understood that the normal methods of torture had little value against those who can draw upon the Force to sustain them. But even a Jedi Master is helpless against her remarkable machine. It attacks the mind and the spirit,"
she explained,
"but leaves the body intact. Any imaginable horror can be inflicted simply by stimulating the receptors of the brain. The pain will feel completely real, but the flesh is unharmed."
Nostoral understood the grim implications of what she was saying. Conventional torture would eventually surpass the limits of physical endurance. Beyond a certain point, the subject would perish. But with Mekkis's infernal machine, no matter how much a victim suffered, the agony would never end.
"Dwelling on the endless horror is another part of the torture,"
the Jedi reminded himself.
"Stay calm. Focus on what you need to do."
When he'd first regained consciousness, Nostoral had no sense of how long he had been out. Despite Carrot's torture, however, he felt his perception of time and space, an awareness born of being closely attuned to the universal power of the Force, returning. A little more than 10 hours had passed since the confrontation in Carrot's inner sanctum. The attack on Duro was still too far away. He needed to hold out for several more hours if his plan was going to work.
"You cannot break me,"
he said, his voice cracking from the strain he had already been put through.
"We both know I can,"
Carrot whispered from just beside him, running her long fingers seductively along the rough skin of the Keldor's cheek.
"But I don't have to. I know you weren't acting alone. A security sweep of the ship captured your friends. If you want to spare them this suffering, you will tell me what I want to know."
Nostoral had to admire the ploy, but he knew she was bluffing. It was possible Theron was somewhere on the ship. He hoped it was true, but he trusted his partner was skilled enough to avoid any kind of security patrol. And Theron was working alone. Carrot had said friends, plural, as if there were more than one.
"I know you're lying, because I came alone."
Carrot pulled her hand away from his face in frustration.
"Again!"
This time it felt like a million long thin needles were impaling every centimeter of his body. They punctured his flesh clean through, sliding through his skin, muscle, sinew, and bone before sliding out the other side. They pierced his internal organs, his eyes, even his skull, stabbing into his brain. He fought against it, trying to summon the Force to ease his suffering. He opened his mouth to recite the Jedi Code to focus his mind and energy. But instead of the soothing words, all that emerged was another endless scream. The needles vanished, disappearing instantly just like the heat and the pressure. And once again, there had been no real harm done to his body, though the memories of the pain lingered.
"The Republic attack on Reaver Station wasn't real,"
Darth Carrot said, her voice finally betraying a hint of her impatience.
"So what was the point of a false alarm? Is a real invasion coming next? One we will dismiss because we think it's just another equipment malfunction?"
"Yes, that's it. You figured it out."
"Or was it deployed to cause confusion?"
Carrot continued, ignoring his obviously false confession.
A distraction, so your allies already on the river station could set some kind of trap? Something that will be waiting for us if we return to port?
The dark side has made you paranoid. It blinds you to the truth. Reject the teachings of the Sith, and you will have clarity and understanding.
Clarity comes through suffering. You will learn that lesson soon enough.
He heard footsteps as she walked away from him, then heard her speaking to someone else, probably her pure-blooded Sith apprentice.
Stay here with the interrogators. Watch the Jedi. Do not underestimate him, and beware of trickery through the Force.
As you wish, Master,
a female voice replied.
We will speak again when I return,
Carrot called out to him.
After a few hours on the table has made you more cooperative.
Nostral wasn't aware of her leaving as the interrogators turned on the machine, and his world became pain. In the hall beyond the interrogation room, Carrot paused long enough to savor her former master's screams before continuing on. Her security sweeps hadn't turned up any other stowaways, though she hadn't expected them to. Sneaking onto her ship was a mission doomed to failure, as evidenced by Nostral's capture. She felt it was far more likely his presence was a feint, a suicidal sacrifice to draw her attention away from the real threat. She'd hoped the Keldor would break easily, but she hadn't really expected that either. Even Darth Mekkis' wondrous device would need time to wear down a Jedi Master. But eventually he would tell her everything she wanted to know. Who he was working with, how he had known to find her on Reaver Station, why they had staged the false Republic attack. Until then, she was going to keep the Ascendant Spear out on deep patrol, safely away from whatever plot the Republic had cobbled together to destroy her. But that wasn't the only precaution she was taking. She took the turbolift to A-Deck, where the highest-ranking officers had their private quarters. There she found the newest additions to her crew ready and waiting for her arrival. Lord Ka'ux was a red-skinned pureblood. Lord Ordiz was a dark-skinned human. They had come to Reaver Station to swear fealty to the newest member of the Dark Council, though Carrot had initially been reluctant to welcome them aboard her vessel, for fear they might one day be tempted to try to take it from her. However, Nostral's attack had made her reconsider her position. Now that she was on the Dark Council, she had to expect there would be other attempts on her life. If not by the Jedi, then by rivals within the Empire. Realizing it might be wise to keep a pair of well-trained warriors by her side at all times, she'd sent a shuttle to the station to retrieve them.
I trust your accommodations are to your liking.
Exquisite,
Lord Ka'ux replied, while Lord Ordiz only bowed his head to show he approved.
Come with me,
she told them.
We must begin your training.
Training, Darth Carrot?
Lord Ka'ux asked.
If you want to serve me, you must learn to serve my ship as well,
she told them.
I promise you'll find the experience rewarding.
Chapter 27. The knife wound on Tefeth's shoulder barely bothered her as she worked the Prosperity's controls, bringing the shuttle out of hyperspace just beyond the mass shadow cast by Coruscant's gravity well. The capital world of the Republic loomed before her in all its glory, a city world with almost a trillion people on the surface. The four moons orbiting the planet were almost lost among the artificial satellites swirling around it. Massive mirror stations collected and redirected light and heat from Coruscant's sun to the poles, transforming every square centimeter of the surface into livable land. Ponderous habitation spheres slowly circled the world, swelling the official population by another 100 billion. And giant space stations directed the endless stream of thousands of ships arriving and departing. Tefeth just stared out the window of the cockpit. It had been almost 2 years since she'd last been here, not since her first run-in with Theron. She'd forgotten how overwhelming the galaxy's most densely populated planet could be when seen from above. The incessant beep of the shuttle's comlink finally snapped her out of her fog, and she reached out to open the channel.
Prosperity, do you read? This is Coruscant Flight Control 473. Prosperity, please acknowledge.
This is Prosperity,
Tefeth answered, realizing the shuttle's auto-transponder must have transmitted the registration directly to the nearest space station for clearance upon her arrival.
What's wrong?
Been trying to hail you for almost 2 full minutes. Might want to check your comm equipment.
Roger,
Tefeth replied, not certain what else to say. She knew how to smuggle a ship onto Coruscant, but she had no idea what the protocols were for a legal landing on the surface.
You looking for surface clearance?
The man asked her after a few seconds of silence.
Roger,
Tefeth agreed. Another few seconds passed before the man asked,
do you have your destination?
He was clearly getting annoyed.
The Jedi,
Tefeth blurted out.
Grandmaster Satil.
There was a long pause on the other end before the man replied.
You are cleared for landing at Diplomatic Spaceport 27B. Transmitting coordinates now.
Roger,
Tefeth said again.
Over and out.
Relieved to put an end to the awkward conversation, Tefeth turned the ship over to the autopilot, allowing it to chart its own course down to the surface. She was surprised she didn't have to wait in some kind of queue or touch down at one of the orbital space stations for some kind of verification before landing. But then she remembered whose shuttle she was flying, and she realized she had probably been given some kind of special priority service. The shuttle plunged down into Coruscant's atmosphere, the autopilot falling into the nearest officially designated flight path as it sped her rapidly to the surface. The ship rattled slightly as it came in, a result of the damage it had sustained crashing through the doors of the hangar during her escape from Jagani Port. But Tefeth barely noticed. Her attention focused on the unimaginable crush of buildings, speeders, and people on the surface. Coruscant truly was a wonder of the galaxy. There were other worlds with endless cityscapes, like the hut-controlled moon of Nar Shaddaa, but none of them rivaled the Republic capital. The tallest, grandest buildings on the hut world would have been dwarfed by even the smallest of Coruscant's sky towers. The general feel of Nar Shaddaa was one of claustrophobia, cramped and crowded. The effect of Coruscant was almost the exact opposite. The towers reaching up forever into the sky, and the endless streams of traffic stretching off to disappear over the horizon made the world appear even larger and grander than it actually was. The autopilot chimed softly, indicating she was nearing her destination. Tefeth switched over to manual control when she saw the spaceport below her. She didn't trust autopilots to bring a ship down smoothly at the best of times, and she feared the Prosperity's damaged hull might throw its precisely calibrated systems off. Diplomatic Spaceport 27B was an arrangement of half a dozen circular landing pads in a circle atop a very large, flat-roofed building. In the center of the landing pads was a small structure that Tefeth guessed housed a turbolift leading to the building's interior, along with a handful of security personnel. A pair of small airspeeders were parked in one corner of the room, with enough space to accommodate several more. The shuttle touched down with a slight thump, and Tefeth killed the engines. She saw two men in official-looking uniforms, one carrying a blaster rifle, the other armed with a pistol, striding out of the central structure toward her vessel, confirming that at least half of her hypothesis was right.
Just like Gorvitch said, coming to arrest us.
She briefly considered firing up the shuttle again and taking off, but she'd come too far to turn back now. Hopefully, the guards would be willing to listen to reason. As she came down the boarding ramp, the two men were waiting patiently. She took it as a good sign that neither one had bothered to ready his weapon yet.
Miss, is there anyone else on your shuttle?
The one with the pistol asked. Tefeth shook her head. She could see the guards exchange a knowing glance and saw their muscles tense up slightly.
Is this your shuttle, miss?
The second wanted to know.
Not ours. Belongs to Jedi, Nostoral.
And where is Master Nostoral, miss?
Had the guards tried to bully or intimidate her, she would have had no trouble dealing with them. But she found this unrelenting politeness, with its thinly veiled undercurrent of suspicion, strangely alarming.
Nostoral not here. Give shuttle to us. We have urgent message for Grandmaster Satil Shan.
Who's we, miss?
The one with the pistol asked.
I thought you said you were alone.
Tefeth rolled her eyes.
We is me. Nobody else. Just me.
She put an unduly heavy emphasis on the final pronoun.
Do you have any identification, miss?
We... I got no time for stupid questions,
she snapped, her composure finally slipping.
Got to see Grandmaster Shan right now.
The guards looked at each other, then back at her.
If you have a message for her, you can give it to us. We'll make sure she gets it.
Tefeth shook her head.
Got to be in person. Now!
The guards must have exchanged some kind of unspoken signal, because suddenly they both had their weapons trained on her.
Miss, please remove your blaster and set it on the ground. Slowly.
Tefeth did as instructed.
Miss, you need to come with us.
We go with you,
Tefeth said, trying to sound calm instead of like some raving lunatic.
But you send message to Grandmaster Shan. Tell her Theron sent us.
While the guard with the blaster rifle kept his weapon pointed at her, the other holstered his pistol and came over to collect her weapon from the ground. Then he gave her a quick pat down, careful to avoid the wound on her shoulder. To her surprise, he didn't slap a pair of stun cuffs on her, only took her by the elbow and led her inside the small structure in the middle of the spaceport, his partner following behind with his weapon still at the ready. It was clear they didn't trust her, but since she'd arrived in a Jedi Master's shuttle, they were hesitant to treat her like a common criminal. As Tefeth suspected, there was a turbolift at the rear of the structure, along with two chairs and a holo terminal. The only door was the one they had just entered, though there were two small windows on each of the side walls.
Sit down, miss, the guard at her elbow said.
Still hoping she could reason with them, she did as instructed.
Send a message to Grandmaster Shan,
she reminded him.
You promised us.
Just try to remain calm, miss. We'll get this sorted out.
Nothing to sort,
she said, rising up from her chair.
Call Shan!
The guard with the blaster rifle took a step back, weapon raised as the other came forward and grabbed her elbow again.
We'll put a question through the proper channels,
he said, hoping to calm her while trying to guide her back into the chair.
Just sit down and relax. Someone is on the way.
Tefeth let her shoulders slump and bowed her head as she started to lower herself into her seat. Thinking she was resigned to her fate, the guard at her elbow relaxed his grip. Instead of sitting down, Tefeth spun free, yanking the pistol from his holster with one hand as she slid around behind him, using his body to shield her from the guard with the blaster rifle. At the same time, she grabbed his wrist with her other hand, twisting his arm up and behind his back while jamming the pistol against the side of his neck. It happened in the blink of an eye. The other guard didn't even have time to cry out in surprise before Tefeth had his partner at her mercy.
Let him go,
he said, raising his blaster rifle. Tefeth twisted her human shield's arm up even farther behind him. He grunted in pain as she peered at the other man from over his shoulder.
You go outside, close the door. Come back in, friend dies.
The guard hesitated, and Tefeth pressed her pistol even harder into her captive's neck.
Listen to her,
he pleaded.
Do what she says.
Keeping his weapon high, the other guard slowly backed up until he was outside the small building. He waited a moment, then ducked to the side and out of Tefeth's line of fire. She braced, fearing he would pop back around the corner to take a shot at her. But instead, the door slid shut as he hit the access panel on the outer wall. Tefeth shoved her captive in the back, sending him stumbling away from her. She raised the blaster and fired, prying the panel by the turbolift and causing the man to let out a sharp yelp as he dropped to the ground. Backing away to the far corner of the room, Tefeth said,
Get up! Use holo! Call Grandmaster Shan.
I don't know how to reach her, he said. I don't have that kind of authority.
Call your boss. Call boss's boss. Get Shan on the hollow or you die.
Okay, he said, getting to his feet. Okay, I'll try.
Tefeth had no idea if her plan would work. She knew in the Empire they'd rather let a hostage die than disturb a Sith Lord with this kind of request. She hoped things were different in the Republic. In the 5 minutes it took the guard to run his request up a chain of superiors, explaining his situation each time, 3 speeders came in to land on the roof outside, each carrying 4 more armed security personnel. Tefeth kept one eye on the guard at the hollow, while the other darted back and forth to the windows at the gathering array of firepower, wondering how long she had until they tried to storm the building. Just as she was about to give up hope of ending this without bloodshed, the man at the hollow said,
"I got her! She's here!"
Tefeth glanced over to see a woman's face on the hollow. She had no idea what Grandmaster Shan looked like, though she thought she could see a faint resemblance in the face to Theron.
"In the corner,"
she said, motioning with the gun.
"Face down. You move, I shoot."
"There's no need for violence,"
the woman on the hollow said as the guard complied with her instructions.
"Let's try to stay calm."
"Try that,"
Tefeth told her, keeping the weapon trained on the guard in the corner.
"Nobody listens. Violence only way to get results."
"I'm here now. I'm listening."
"You Grandmaster Satir Shan?"
"I am."
"Message from Theron. Needs your help. Sends me to tell you."
From the expression on the woman's face, Tefeth knew Satil was who she claimed to be. She also knew Satil had no doubt that she was telling the truth.
"What happened? What's wrong?"
"Not here,"
Tefeth said, shaking her head.
"Too many ears. Somewhere private."
"Do you want to come to me? Or should I come to you?"
Tefeth glanced out the window to see more than 20 armed guards waiting on the roof outside.
"You come here. We're not going anywhere."
30 seconds after ending her hollow call with Satil, Tefeth saw the guards outside pulling back and lowering their weapons, though none of them left. 5 minutes later, another airspeeder touched down, this one carrying a single figure in a brown robe. Ignoring the armed guards, she jumped from her speeder and walked quickly toward where Tefeth was holed up. As she drew closer, the Twi'lek recognized her as the woman from the hollow call. She paused at the door.
"It's Grandmaster Satil Shan," she said. "Get up,"
Tefeth said to the man still lying on the ground.
"Open the door."
He did as instructed. Satil glanced from the guard to Tefeth, then back to the guard before stepping inside.
"Go,"
she said to the guard.
"And take the rest of your CSF friends with you. This is Jedi business."
The man looked back at Tefeth, then bolted for freedom when she nodded. Satil closed the door behind him, sealing the two of them alone in the room.
"You don't need that pistol anymore," she said.
Tefeth glanced down at her hand, surprised to realize she was still holding the blaster. She quickly set it on the chair beside her.
"You said Theron sent you?"
the Jedi said.
"He needs my help?"
"Nosdural, too. Try to tell guards. We don't listen."
"Tell me everything," Satil said, "starting with your name."
Chapter 28 Theron popped the salt tablets and downed the last of the water from his second ration kit, hoping it would be enough to keep his body hydrated and his muscles from cramping for a few more hours in the sweltering engine room. He was nearly finished mapping the Ascendant Spear's control systems. He only had a handful of relays left to go. And as he had become more and more familiar with the systems, he started writing pre-programmed subroutines to disrupt the ship's operations. One to disable the hyperdrive, another to take down the shields, a third to throw off the targeting systems of the laser cannons. He saved each subroutine as he created it in his cybernetic implant, storing them electronically for later reference, much the way he might memorize a list of names or numbers using his organic memory. Later he'd be able to call them up and deploy them in rapid succession against Carrot and her ship, giving the Republic fleet a fighting chance when they faced off against the Spear over Duro. There was just one problem with his plan. So far, he had heard nothing about the Spear making preparations to go to Duro. Master Nosdural had assured Theron he'd convince Carrot to go there, but Theron had no way to know if his friend was alive or dead. He'd been listening to the commands issued to and from the vessel's bridge ever since he'd sliced into the comm channels, but so far he hadn't heard a word about the Jedi, and the only orders Carrot had given the Spear were to stay out in deep space until they knew more about the feigned attack on Reaver Station. His slicer spike pinged, notifying him that it had finished mapping the current relay. Theron disconnected it and scanned the data. The information transmitted wirelessly from the spike to the implant in his left eye, superimposing the image over his normal vision. He recognized a familiar pattern from a previous relay, one that indicated a holding cell, complete with security cams providing live images. The previous cell Theron had stumbled across had been empty.
He tapped into the cams, hoping to see Nosterol, only to be faced with an empty room. He hadn't thought to look for another holding cell, however. Reattaching the slicer spike to the relay, he established a connection with the security cams, projecting the image onto his visual overlay. This time, he found what he was looking for. Nosterol was alive, strapped to some kind of table. His robe and most of his clothes had been stripped away. Even on the low-quality image, there was no mistaking the Keldor's exposed body. Theron carefully used his link with the cam to have it pan slowly around the room. The Jedi was not alone. In addition to a pair of Imperial soldiers, there was also a female Sith pureblood in the room, watching over him. From her black robes and facial tattoos, it wasn't hard to assume she was a follower of the dark side. She was probably Darth Carrad's apprentice, tasked with making sure the prisoner didn't escape. Moving the cam back to its original position, Theron cut the feed. He had no idea if the Sith would be able to sense him spying on them through the Force, but he didn't want to take any chances. Besides, he'd seen all he needed to see. His mind quickly ran through his options. He could try to help the Jedi escape, but was that what Nosterol wanted? He told Theron he was going to convince Darth Carrad to go to Duro. Was getting captured part of the plan? Did he know his former Padawan well enough to think he could manipulate her into going to Duro by allowing her to interrogate him? It was a tactic SIS had used in the past, though the success rate wasn't high. Sometimes the targets saw through the ruse and refused to take the bait. Other times they simply killed their prisoner before the false information could be fed to them. There was no way to know if getting caught was actually a calculated gamble by his partner, or if something had simply gone terribly wrong with his original plan. But if something had gone wrong, Theron realized there wasn't much he could do to help. He might be able to overpower the guards, or the Sith individually, but he doubted he could handle all of them together. And even if he did, breaking Nosterol from his prison would only alert Carrad that her old master wasn't the only one who had infiltrated the spear. The entire ship would go into lockdown until they were both found. Most important of all, rescuing Nosterol did nothing to address the problem of getting the spear to Duro in the next 12 hours. If getting captured was part of his plan, rescuing him would ruin everything. If it wasn't, they were doomed anyway. Hard as it was, Theron had to leave Nosterol in enemy hands, trusting that his partner knew what he was doing. Trying not to think about what the Imperials would do to the Keldor, he returned to his work, attaching the slicer spike to the next relay. But it was impossible to push the Jedi completely from his mind. If Nosterol was going to do something to deliver Carrad and the spear into the hands of the Republic, he had to do it soon. Time was running out. This time, Nosterol's torment was cold. Not the cold of bitter wind or a frozen world, but the black chill of the grave. He could feel his flesh rot and decay, his skin growing taut, his bones becoming hollow and brittle before crumbling into dust. When the suffering abruptly and mercifully ended, Nosterol's mind teetered on the brink of madness, shattered by hours upon hours of unspeakable torments. Even as he sought refuge in an ocean of dementia and delusion, some small part of him fought to cling to the last threads of his sanity. Had the Sith ordered another immediate bout of torture, he would have succumbed, sinking into the depths of lunacy. Instead, she commanded the interrogators to halt. Perhaps sensing how close he was to being lost forever, and knowing the punishments Darth Carrad would inflict if she failed to uncover his secrets.
"Are you ready to talk now, Jedi?"
she asked, still struggling to sort reality from the crazed pain hallucinations creeping around the edges of his mind. Nosterol could only whisper,
"No more. No more."
"You can end this," the Sith told him. "Tell Darth Carrad what she wants to know, and your suffering will be over."
"I will talk. No more. I will talk. No more. I will talk. No more."
Turning away from the babbling Keldor, the apprentice said,
"Inform Darth Carrad that the prisoner is ready for her."
By the time Darth Carrad arrived a few minutes later, Nosterol had regained much of his composure. though he was careful to keep playing the part of a broken victim. Given his current state, it was an easy role to slip into.
"No more. I will talk,"
he mumbled as he heard Carrot's familiar footsteps approach.
"I will talk."
"I told you I would break you,"
the Falling whispered in his ear.
"Now that you have tested the power of the dark side, you can understand why I left the Jedi to follow Malgus."
"I will talk. No more. I will talk."
"Why did you come aboard my vessel? Why face me and my apprentices? Why enter a battle you knew you couldn't win?"
"A distraction. Keep you away."
"Away? Away from what?"
"Duro. The attack on Duro."
"How do you know about that?"
Though blind without his protective goggles, he knew Carrot was watching him closely, studying him, analyzing his words to see if he was lying. The best way to keep her from recognizing his deception was to blend fact and fiction, seed his lies with bits of truth.
"The Black Cipher. We crack the codes."
He could sense Carrot suddenly stand up straight, shocked by the news.
"That's how we found you. We intercepted a message that you were going to Reaver Station."
"How long have you had this cipher?"
she demanded, crouching down beside him again.
"Since Zyost."
He didn't need to say any more for her to know what he was talking about. And the less he said, the harder it would be for her to get a read on him.
"You came to the station. You attacked me on my ship. You staged a false Republic invasion fleet, all to make sure we didn't go to Duro?"
"We were afraid of you. The Republic is setting an ambush at Duro. But we can't spare enough ships to bring down the spear. You would turn the battle against us."
"My ship was never part of the fleet heading to Duro,"
Carrot said, and he heard the suspicion in her voice.
"You are on the Dark Council. You choose your own path,"
Nosterol explained, remembering how headstrong she had been as his Padawan, as he played even further to her pride.
"We feared you would defy the will of the Minister of War and come to Duro to claim your share of the glory."
"Then why are you telling me this now? Are you hoping I will show you mercy?"
Nosterol tried to laugh, but all that came out was a hollow, haunted rasping of breath.
"My plan worked. It's too late. We are too far away. You'll never get to Duro in time for the battle."
Now it was Carrot's turn to laugh.
"You're wrong, Master. You have no idea how fast my ship really is. When the Republic spring their trap at Duro, we will be there."
Carrot stood up and headed for the door.
"Watch him. No more torture. I want him alive and sane, so he can witness our destruction of Duro and the Republic fleet."
"Should we send a message to warn Moff Nezor about the ambush?"
her apprentice asked.
"The Republic has broken the cipher codes,"
Carrot snapped.
"Sending the message now will only let them know we're coming. They might even abandon their plan. Better to sacrifice a few of our own ships than to let the Republic fleet escape."
"Forgive me, Master,"
the apprentice replied.
"There is so much I still have to learn."
"Tell Moff Lorman to set a course for Duro. Maximum speed,"
she ordered before leaving the room.
"I've done all I can, Theron," the old Jedi thought. "Now, it's up to you."
Deep in the bowels of the engine room, Theron finally heard the orders he'd been waiting for coming from the bridge.
"Set a course for Duro."
A klaxon rang out three times across the ship, the signal for the crew to prepare for the jump to hyperspace. A moment later, the hyperdrive core began to howl as it ramped up to full power.
"He did it. Somehow Master Nosterol did it."
Theron redoubled his efforts, knowing he had to finish mapping the relays if the ambush was going to stand any chance of taking down the Ascendant Spear. Assuming there actually was an ambush. Nostral had done his job, and Theron was busy doing his, but none of it would matter if Tefeth and Satil couldn't convince Jace to send a Republic fleet to Duro. Chapter 29. No! Jace said, slamming his fist down on the back of the couch he was standing by.
This is insane.
Satil's call had woken him in the middle of the night. When she told him she was coming over right away to see him, he'd still been too bleary from the shots he'd shared with Marcus earlier to ask any questions or protest. Not that he would have refused a request. He and Satil had spoken many times since she'd ended their relationship. Given their respective roles in the Republic and the Jedi Order, it was inevitable. But their meetings had always been official, held in offices or meeting rooms. She'd never come to his apartment before, so he knew whatever business she had was urgent. The Grand Master of the Jedi Order was not a woman prone to overreaction. By the time she'd shown up at his door, Jace's mind was right enough to guess what this was about. Somehow she'd found out about Theron, the Spear, and the impending attack on Duro that was now less than 10 hours away. He expected she would try to talk him out of his plan. What he hadn't expected was the scruffy-looking Twi'lek street thug who accompanied the Grand Master, nor the wild story she told.
Do you know how many laws and regulations Theron violated by roping you into this?
He shouted at her. Satil and the Twi'lek were standing side by side in the middle of his living room, a united front opposing him.
Theron could be court-martialed,
Jace continued, stepping around from behind the couch and moving toward them as his voice got louder and louder.
Arrested! This is bordering on treason!
You shout at him, not me!
Tefeth snapped back, holding her ground and refusing to be intimidated by his bluster.
None of that matters now, Satil told him. Theron and Master Nostral will bring the Ascendant Spear to Duro. You need to be there waiting for them.
You don't know that, Jace said. You just met this Twi'lek. For all we know, she's an Imperial agent, leading us into some kind of trap.
I can sense the truth in her words, Satil assured him.
Jace snorted.
And you couldn't possibly be wrong, because no Jedi in history has ever been betrayed by someone close to them. You Jedi may see more than the rest of us, but you don't see nearly as much as you think.
Sometimes we're blind when it comes to those close to us, Satil admitted. But I'm right about this,
she added with the resolute calm Jace had found so infuriating when they were together.
We can trust Tefeth.
Even if she's on our side.